Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter, Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott. Unfortunately, we've got sad news to begin this episode with one of our former guests, Craig, a friend of yours, a fellow Florida author, Tim Dorsey, passed away recently.
Yeah, it was such a shock to everybody. He was 62 years old, and it was just way too young. And Tim had written 26 books about his brilliant sequential killer, as he preferred to be called, not serial killer, Florida-obsessed sequential killer, Serge Storms, and his perpetually stoned buddy, Coleman, who roam around Florida, appreciating what a great state it is, and also killing everybody who would risk who would risk the ruination of this wonderful paradise we live in. And Tim was such a great guy. He was just as funny in person as he was on the page. I served on several book panels with him, including a panel at BoucherCon, which is this convention for mystery writers that they held here in St. Petersburg in 2018. We actually did a panel on doing crime the Florida man way. And it was packed mostly, I think, because of Tim. People wanted to see Tim and hear what he had to say. And he was a hoot. He really was. But he also took care to look out for younger writers and also to sort of pay respects to the people who helped to shape him. We both were invited to appear, and he had some very moving things to say for John D. McDonald's centennial in Sarasota in 2016. And, you know, I just feel bad for his family. They lost their mom not too long ago, and now they've lost their dad, his two girls. And it's just, and we readers have lost a source of perpetual amusement. So that's very sad too.
Episode 73, I believe it was, if you want to go back and listen to our conversation with Tim Dorsey. We'll move along to your latest Florida Phoenix column, floridaphoenix.com. We head to horse country, but we're not talking about four-leggeds today. It's up in the air.
Yeah. It's this place called Jumbo Lair, one of the amazing little communities around Florida. You know, we've got a place founded by retired postal carriers. We've got one founded by retired circus midgets. And this one, Jumbo Lair, which is this community near Ocala, that is, it's a gated community for wealthy airplane owners who want to park their 707 in their driveway. And the name Jumbo Lair comes from when it was an elephant sanctuary, a lair for Jumbo, founded by the guy who invented the Nautilus exercise machine and his wife, a former Revlon Charlie girl model. I mean, it's
amazing. Just, yeah,
it's very Florida. And then the current owner wants to expand far beyond the I think 38 or so lots. He wants to basically add nearly 500 new homes in Jumbo Lair, and the people who live around there are freaking out because they like the nice, quiet, rural vibe, and they don't want this city full of 500 more airplanes suddenly popping up in their midst and driving their horses nuts.
John Travolta is a part of this story. We did an episode previously on Florida horse country, and you're talking about a rural area, and we think it's an airstrip. You know, the way you're going to bring the wing over Cessna with the prop. No, I mean, you've got like commercial jumbo jet sized airplanes.
It's the longest privately owned runaway in America. I mean, that's how
it's commercial grade. I mean, you can land heavy duty jumbo jets here, and obviously Florida horse country has a vibe they're looking for that is not airport adjacent.
And the owner, there are accusations that he has a helicopter that he flies low and slow over the homes of people who were opposing his development project, and of course freaking the horses out. One person said it sounded like living inside the opening credits for MASH.
it's an extraordinary story. Most of us don't live in gated communities or own private aircraft, but Craig has done a fantastic job of making this a relatable, interesting story. There's an overhead photo of John Travolta's home in this, I'll call it a community, with literally a 707 parked in the driveway as if it were the family grocery getter. It is it looks like it's photoshopped. It's to say it's incongruous, but you know, the house is probably 30,000 square feet and there's a jumbo jet with a wingspan of, you know, I don't know, 200-300. It's just it's nuts.
All mind-blowing. It's
yeah,
all
the whole thing is nuts, but
it's plain crazy.
It sure is. FloridaPhoenix.com. Want to thank all of our supporters at Patreon.com. Patreon.com/Welcome to Florida. For as little as $5 a month, you can help support the production of the podcast. Craig and I are going to have another bonus episode released there very soon about our favorite Florida, Florida books and movies and museums, state parks, that kind of thing. And perhaps popping up on that list will be Scarface, which is our subject today. And Scarface, the Al Pacino Scarface, celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. It was released in 1983. Nat Segeloff has written the book Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface. It was out this year. And we've done so many episodes on this era of South Florida, Craig. The 1980 in Miami episode is still my all-time favorite. We've done Hotel Scarface. We've done the Cuban boat lift, Mary Alito's Cuban immigrants. This is another log for the fire there.
Yeah, and another sign, too, of how cultural things involving Florida become so incredibly influential. And we'll definitely get into that with Nat.
Well, and perhaps if you are of the private jet class, you can afford the Fontainebleau Miami Beach's Dinner with Al Pacino event. When you said this to me, I couldn't. I was like, with real Al Pacino. December 9th. Put this one in your calendars.
Say hello to my big wallet.
December 9th, the famed Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach is going to host a dinner with the actual Al Pacino, Tony Montana, from Scarface. And if you want to attend, I will have a link to that event in the show notes. But for the rest of us, we will have to suffice with just watching the movie and listening to Nat Segeloff and reading his book on the movie.
Do you want to play rough? Okay. No. Say hello to my little friend.
Thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. And what a fascinating, fascinating topic. What prompted you to write this book about Scarface?
It was the 40th anniversary, and editors seem to have a great fondness for anything that's an even number, although 25 is pretty good, too. But also, the movie was really given a bum's rush when it first came out in 1983, and it's acquired quite a positive reputation since then. I wanted to find out what had happened both to the movies and to America over those years. And then, of course, that meant stretching back to 1932 with the original Scarface starring Paul Muni that Howard Hughes produced. And so it's really just about a century of Scarface to find out how you take something set in Prohibition and set it in the cocaine era and how politics have changed and how movies have changed.
Well, tell us a little bit about the original, the with Paul Muni. That was based on Al Capone, right?
Well, yes and no. In fact, that's part of the story we tell. Ben Hecht, who wrote the screenplay, very famously tells the story in his wonderful memoir, Child of the Century. I say memoir versus autobiography because memoirs are selective. And Ben Hecht was nothing if not a fantasist. He said he'd finished the screenplay, and all of a sudden, a couple of guys came to see him in his office, and they had bulges in their suits, and he knew exactly who they were. And they says, "Oh, you the guy that wrote this screenplay, Scarface?" And Ben Heck said he was. And he said, "So is it about Al Capone or what?" And they had exchanged some words. You know, I knew Big Jim Colosimo. I knew this guy. I knew that guy. And they said, "Well, is it about Scarface?" And Ben has said, "No, it's not about Scarface." And Capone's people said, "Well, if it isn't about Scarface, how come it's called Scarface?" And he said, "Well, you see, Al Capone is one of the most fascinating and famous men of our time. If we call it Scarface, people will want to see the movie. That's part of the racket we call showmanship." And so the guys were on the way out the door. One of them turned and said, "By the way, who's this fellow Howard Hughes?" Who, of course, was the producer. And Ben Hecht wrote, for the first time, he could be honest with him. He says, "Oh, don't worry about him. He's just the sucker with the money." Well, that was the spirit of Scarface, which was directed rather flamboyantly by Howard Hawks, who had been making silent films and, of course, had come over to sound and made just a bravura film with camera movement and sound and symbolism and Paul Muni really pushing the edges of the envelope as Tony Camonte. And the film was very brutal for its time, and in fact ran into opposition from the Hays Code. That's the Motion Picture Producers and Directors of America, who'd established the censorship code to save themselves from being censored by every local community. And they had to make some changes in the film. They had to tone down the incest angle, which Brian De Palma and Oliver Stone had no problem exploiting in the 1983 version. They had to cut out some of the violence, and they had to make sure that the Al Capone character, Scarface, Tony Camonte, was killed at the end, because originally, in the original script, he had shot his way out and shot one of the policemen in the face. So they had to change that. They had to fabricate an ending to which neither Paul Muni nor Howard Hawks was a participant. And by that token, he got released. And one of the things that somebody told me, and I won't say where, there's a supporting character named Vince Barnett, who plays a character called Stoop, which means stupid. He's supposed to be the comic relief, although he's really rather clumsy. And twice in the film, under his breath, he says the F word. I had missed it, but then I went back and listened on a digitally restored soundtrack, and sure enough, he says it. I'm not going to say it here because a goldfish might be listening, but it's
oh, you know our listenership.
And it got through, and it's been there for since 1932, and you can still hear it.
Well, so this is probably a one of the ways in which society has changed. How many F-bombs are in the 1983 version?
I lost count at 200. There are some people who have 182. There are some people who say there's more than that, 225. What I think is remarkable is not just the number of F-bombs, but if you look at the film watching subtitles for the hearing impaired, somebody had to sit down and transcribe all those F's. I can imagine some poor person, probably a woman knowing Universal, some stuck in some office at Universal Pictures, who has to, you know, stop and start the transcript and keep on writing F-U-C-K. It must
have been maybe she had it on a save string, so she could just drop it in, drop the whole word
right,
in.
Right. Macro my F.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So whose idea was it to remake this movie? You mentioned that Al Pacino is a big fan, but was he really the driving force behind remaking the original?
Every indication is that Al Pacino was, although his former manager, then producer, Martin Bregman, claims credit for it, too. Pacino supposedly was walking down Sunset Boulevard, which I can't imagine, but there's a theater called the Tiffany on Sunset Boulevard, which at the time, in the early 80s, was a revival cinema. And Pacino wandered in because they were showing Scarface. Now, Scarface had been under confiscation for decades because Howard Hughes was so angry with the film companies and with the censorship office for wanting him to cut his film that he simply pulled it out of distribution.
Wow.
There were a lot of bootleg prints going around, which is how I saw the film originally. But this was the first legitimate booking that Universal had obtained at the Tiffany. And Pacino saw it and came out saying he wants to be Paul Muni. So he called his producer partner, Martin Bregman. And you can imagine what would happen. Martin Bregman then picked up the phone and called Universal Pictures, which not only had made Carlito's Way and knew a lot about Pacino and loved him. And the deal took about 5 minutes to set up.
Dang.
because they owned the rights.
Yeah.
And then the hardship became who was going to direct it, who was going to write it, and how was it going to be financed? And that's part of what the book, Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface, is about. How this film came about.
At what point did they decide to jump it forward into the modern day? Because what a brilliant idea. But I mean,
Brian De Palma, it was originally going to be a remake set in Prohibition. And Brian De Palma and his screenwriter, David Rabe, had started to write it. And they really couldn't figure out how to set this in the Prohibition era. Now, put a pin in that thought for a moment and realize that Brian De Palma later made The Untouchables.
A great movie,
era, yeah. Which was set in the Prohibition era.
Yeah.
But for Scarface, it didn't quite work out. And so he kind of left the project, although there's a big question about whether he left or was taken off. But in other words, he left. David Rabe didn't want to meet anybody. He went off and he started prepping Prince of the City, which became a project that Sidney Lumet eventually directed. And Brian has always claimed that Sidney Lumet stole Prince of the City from him when it was practically ready to go, because Sidney Lumet had suggested about Scarface, you know, if you set it in the cocaine era, you have the same laws restricting it, you have the same mob operation, you have the same kind of public sentiment surrounding it, and it was a perfect fit. Eventually, they had Oliver Stone adapted, and Oliver Stone had his own familiarity, shall we say, with cocaine, and which he freely admits in his marvelous biography, Waiting for the Light. And he adapted it into the movie, which we see, although it, you know, went through the normal number of changes. But Stone was so brilliant, and he had wanted to be a director at the time. He'd made a couple of small films. But here he was watching somebody else direct a movie, and it was just a confluence of energies and talents that produced Scarface.
So it comes out, it's 1983, obviously, the height of these drug cartel cocaine period in South Florida, Reagan's war on drugs, DEA, the whole thing. It's the lead story on the network news, Dan Rather, every single night, Peter Jennings. Hits the theaters and people, it's reviled. Why did it generate such a visceral negative response from critics and audiences initially?
Scarface 1983 is an extraordinarily violent film. I don't know if the F-bombs were what people objected to so much as cutting off somebody's leg with a chainsaw, shooting people, blowing people up. It was unbelievably violent, so violent that it almost became, to those of us who have a dark sense of humor, a kind of a comedy, an opera, because you couldn't possibly have that kind of violence. But the critics at the time, and remember, this was the Christmas picture in 1983. I think people might have had a little opposition to that. Some of the critics got it. David Anson, who not only was an old friend, but was the critic for Newsweek, gave me a wonderful interview trying to understand why people might not have liked the film. It did not receive a very good review from the press, and it had a struggle in theaters, too, making its money back. And this is the interesting thing, because, and you're going to work this up with the next two questions, I'll broach it right now. In about 10 years, it became a favorite of the hip-hop community, the urban community, people of color, primarily African-Americans. And, of course, we can go into that in a moment. But the thing is that Universal Pictures, who has a marvelous publicity department, simply didn't recognize that audience as being discreet. They thought it was a violent gangster-like picture, sort of like The Godfather, and they should sell it to the normal, 80% of the population. They really didn't understand much about the so-called urban audience, and they paid the price for it until it caught on again, and now it's a big thing. What's interesting, why the film is so popular among people of color, there are no black people in the movie. None that I can see. Everybody is Cuban American or Hispanic or one way or another, Latino. And yet it has a wonderful appeal all across the board.
Well, but I think, to a young African American audience, and I am not any of those things. I am not young. I am not African American, but thinking of that hip hop era, because this comes out in 1983, hip hop is starting to get its footing, which 20 years later would have it be the number one cultural phenomenon in the world. Here's a guy who came from nothing on the streets, and by violence, chicanery, hook or by crook, made it big. And he went down hard, but he made it. And if you look at rap music, That's the theme throughout. Tony Montana is not black, but if this were Biggie Smalls or Tupac, it could, he could stand in for those characters.
He speaks the yearnings of a deprived and oppressed audience. And in fact, Bill Stefanie, who's one of the founders of Public Enemy, gave me some wonderful information for the book, because he and his crew, when they were kids, they discovered the film right away. And it took a while, I think, before other people were able to latch onto the popularity.
Some people get it. It's got this very avant-garde. It's almost got a grindhouse feel because it's so violent, but Al Pacino's a big star, and Michelle Pfeiffer's becoming a big star. 10 years or so passes, and it's iconic. It's on all the lists. It's legendary. What you tease this, as we started talking, what changed in the film industry? What changed in America between 1983 and, the 1990s when this is an iconic film?
Cable television. The film was sold to cable and it went into people's homes. Mind you, it was a film that was almost rated X, and here it is showing where little kids can see it in television. This shows an enormous hypocrisy. And people started watching it in the privacy of their own homes with their crew, with their friends. And like a lot of other movies, which were ignored at first and made it big on television, the polar opposite would be It's a Wonderful Life. A lot of movies were discovered in the privacy of people's homes, and then it just took off. So I'm sure the DVD sales and the merchandising have long since outstripped what the grosses were. Oh,
the Scarface poster, that poster, what I forget what the tagline is, you know, he took the world or something like this, but Tony Montana with the M16 with the grenade launcher and the suit. Yeah. It would just, you know, I was in college in the 90s. It was all over the place, you know, the Scarface poster. And in 1983, I would have been 8 years old. And those people who had that poster saw the film in the theater, obviously.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I think kept it romantic, and you'd know this more than I in Florida, is that there was, in fact, a romance to the cocaine trade. I hate to say that because it was brutal. But on the outside, so many people, parentheses, white executives, closed parentheses, were using cocaine that we didn't care how it came in to the country. And one of the bullets that the producers dodged was it wasn't until 1984, the year after the film was released, that crack became a part of the American landscape. Mm. That was a whole different thing. And people certainly reflected in the laws and in the enforcement. You know, white people were busted for powdered cocaine and got off fairly easily. People of color were busted for crack and they went to jail for 10 or 20 years.
Yeah.
So part of what the book discusses is this dichotomy in the legal system. And what had happened when drugs came in, but there was still a tad of romance in the cocaine.
Well, era. Sure. I mean, again, at that point, again, whether you want to admit it or not, cocaine was sexy, glamorous, you know, celebrities, athletes, you know, lawyers, executives, politicians. Crack had none of that quite obviously, but cocaine was a party drug. It was, the New York nightclub, which failed.
Studio 54.
Yeah, that whole thing. And clearly there was a dark side, a violent side. But the film, obviously, it did tap into the glamour as well. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer in the white dress, that's sexy. Yeah.
As Robin Williams famously said, cocaine is God's way of telling you you're too rich.
Well, on that note, let me ask you, now, Oliver Stone, he did more research than just putting a lot of white powder up his nose. He actually came to Florida and did research for the script, right?
He came to Florida. He went to Medellin. He went to where the cartels are. In fact, he was almost killed when he was asking questions. And pretty soon the people who were equally high in the room, who were dealers and who were cartel members, forgot that he was a screenwriter and began to think that he was a Fed or a DEA person.
Oh my.
He literally got out by the skin of his teeth. It's a harrowing experience that he writes about. I have a sidebar about it in the book. But Oliver Stone was completely gracious in speaking with me about that. And also with another journalist named David Cano, who interviewed him at great depth also. Mm-hmm. So Stone is just remarkable. And so many talents were contributing to this film.
Yeah. I have to ask, I love the part in your book about the Miami City councilman who wanted to forbid the movie studio from using any city resources while they were filming there.
Well, this was a fellow who was looking out for his constituents who he didn't want to, they were Cuban and he didn't want to have Cubans slandered by the movie. And he had many meetings with the producers. It turned out later that he not only owned the local newspaper, but he was convicted of a certain amount of fraud in what he was doing with some of the tenants in the property that he owned in the town. So
it's a very Florida story.
Yeah, people who live in glass houses, you know, as they say. But the producers, in fact, left Florida because of pressure from the Cuban community, even though people tried to intercede, such as Stephen Bauer, who played Pacino's friend and sidekick, Manny, in the film. He's Cuban, and he tried to intercede and help things. But at some point, the producers had to take the film out of Cuba and go and shoot most of it in Los Angeles. Then they came back for a couple of days to do some pickup shots. But because of a local businessman, and of course, the film is very specific in the disclaimer that it shows at the very beginning that it represents only a small part of the Cuban community. But as we know, the Miami Cubans are very conservative, and I'm sure they were on edge about how they might be portrayed.
Someone who is not Cuban is Al Pacino, yet he plays a Cuban immigrant, a Marielito, Tony Montana, who goes on to be this big drug kingpin. What research did he do into the Cuban immigrant lifestyle in South Florida, that experience, so if any, to channel the character?
There was a dialogue coach assigned, Robert Easton, who was a dialogue coach to many, many celebrities. But the person from whom Pacino learned the most about the Cuban community was Stephen Bauer, who's Cuban, part German. And they got together every day for about a month or so before filming in Pacino's beach house in Malibu. Stephen lived down the street, and he did not have a beach house in Malibu, but Pacino did. And they'd get together. And as Stephen says in his wonderful foreword to the book, I taught Al how to be a Cuban, and Al taught me how to be an actor. So there was a real blending. They became like brothers, as they were in the film too, that closeness. And it just really rubbed off on both of them. And why Pacino, before you ask, turned down the corners of his mouth and snarled most of his dialogue, I don't know. It just seemed like a muscular thing that was right for him. And let Al Pacino do what Al Pacino wants.
At least he didn't say hoo-ha.
No, but he didn't.
But speaking of catchphrases, who wrote Say Hello to My Little Friend? How did that get into the script and on the screen, I guess?
I asked Oliver Stone about that, and I also read several versions of the script. It's in the final version of the script, but that doesn't mean it wasn't ad-libbed beforehand. Oliver was very gracious and said he didn't remember who wrote it. But the actual line is, say hello to my little friend here. And either the gunfire or Pacino in the take they use covered that up. It became, of course, the iconic phrase that applies not only to Scarface, but to a myriad other things.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Including my book. But
let's not forget that.
Not least. Yeah.
Well, what was the reaction in Miami when the movie first came out? Was it as bad as it was elsewhere?
I don't know in particular. I'm sure it got its share of reviews, but I wasn't tracking what was happening to the critics. As a former critic, I don't really give a shit what other critics think. I'm just that arrogant. So I didn't, only in rare cases will I quote reviews in any of my books.
How influential was this movie on other movies, on subsequent movies?
And not at all, because it flopped. That's the problem. Later, the technology that was advanced, the use of explosive squib and other things, certainly changed the way movies were done until digital came in. And now anybody can explode without even having a charge on them. But, you know, it was not that influential in the sense of the style, because De Palma has a style all his own. It wasn't influential in terms of the story, because you have a good guy and a bad guy, and the bad guy's rising through the ranks. But it was not the story as much as the way it was carried out. The bravura camera work, the floating images, the brilliant compositions. It was making a piece of art out of what would ordinarily be just a slasher shooter film. Mm-hmm. That's what De Palma was able to do. His vocabulary of cinema is so strong that he brings you in not to shame you for enjoying it so much, but to allow you to appreciate the artistry of what he's doing.
And you, obviously, being a critic and in the film industry for a long time, you've got the language. And I was writing down some notes here, and my descriptions, you know, it's so incredibly colorful. You know, the light, the bright color of South Florida, but it's sweaty, it's gritty, it's sleazy, it's sexy, the fashion. I mean, I'm sure all of those were conscious choices to create this aesthetic for the film that really pops.
Southern Florida is so insanely beautiful that to have these ugly things going on behind the scenes or in the shadows makes the kind of stark contrast that creates drama.
Let's talk for a minute. We've mentioned Michelle Pfeiffer a couple of times. Let's talk for a minute about how she wound up in the film. She was not a star when she was cast.
This is only her second or third film, I think. In fact, she had been in Grease 2, which nobody saw, and I forget what else. But not only is she strikingly beautiful and amazingly talented, she went in for a simple casting call and had the misfortune to have nicked Al Pacino when she was moving. There was a bit of tension there, but he understood how beautiful she is. You know, she plays a trophy wife, but she also plays it quite unlike Anne Dvorak in the original film. I'm sorry, the Polly Moran in the original film. She plays her with a real integrity, to the point where she tells Tony, goodbye at the end of the film. She walks out on him and she maintains her integrity. One hopes to go into drug treatment and to straighten her life out.
Yeah, no kidding.
But unlike in the 1932 film where his wife simply vanishes and all of a sudden Poppy vanishes, here Michelle Pfeiffer's character just holds her own all the way through and sticks up to Tony and eventually strands him. And that's, you know, sort of what pushes him over. So she is a woman of great integrity to begin with. And in fact, wanted to show her progression to the ravages of cocaine use by starving herself in the course of making the film. And she was such skin and bones, which she is anyway, that she says members of the crew were trying to force bagels on her on the set to try to put some meat back on her bones. It was so concerned.
Yeah, I don't know how tall she is, but it's hard to believe she's 110 pounds in that film. I mean, she is, I mean, waifish, like that heroin chic kind of look. But again, it so well captures the vibe, the aesthetic. You know, it's almost a, I guess, what do you call that, method acting, something like when Christian Bale gains 80 pounds to play some sort of sloppy guy. You know, she went the other direction, and it just, the authenticity there, and that's why they're brilliant actors, right? That's why he's Al Pacino and she's Michelle Pfeiffer, because they can become these other people.
Well, the camera adds 10 pounds, and if they use two cameras, that's 20 pounds, right? So she's okay.
Yeah. Well, and I thought it was interesting reading your book. It seems like the crew and the actors knew they had it. They really felt that they had made a great piece of cinema here, despite no one else seemingly thinking so initially.
You know, nobody tries to make a bad film. Well, actually, I do know a couple people who have.
Yeah, well.
Nobody really tries to. And in fact, one of the hazards on a film with Brian De Palma is that he gets so involved in making the film that he sometimes doesn't have the niceties and he doesn't compliment people as much as he ordinarily would. He's considered a cold director, which is interesting because his films are so hot. But I think they knew they were working on something which was really high class. I mean, look at John A. Alonso. John Alonso, the director of photography, was not only a middleman with the Spanish-speaking community. He, you know, shot so many films for Martin Ritt. He shot Chinatown. You know, we're talking about one of the great directors of photography who was also very, very political in his own life and brought those politics to the kind of aura that surrounded the whole production. It's just a remarkable thing that the picture got made. And of course, you know, they were shut down for a couple of days when Al Pacino, in firing the gun when he was fighting off Sosa's men at the end, made the mistake of grabbing the barrel of the gun that had just fired and it stuck to his hand.
Oh!
And while he was having his burns treated and was out for a couple of days, Brian De Palma said, well, we have to keep on shooting. So they kept on shooting people, you know, Scarface's point of view, anybody attacked, which is why the ending is so incredibly violent. They had nothing else to shoot. They wrapped the film, so they just kept on shooting people. In fact, even Steven Spielberg, who had come down to visit De Palma, shot a couple of the shots. So you had some uncredited Spielberg work in there. It was, oh, sure, pick up a megaphone and shoot somebody. And that's why the orgy of violence at the end of Scarface is so profound. Because they had nothing else to shoot except each other.
We have to keep shooting.
Exactly.
Now, Stone, I was surprised to read your book, but Stone is not a fan of the film. He didn't like how it turned out.
Well, he wanted to be a director himself. And in fact, I think he has given the airy eyeball when he showed up on the set one day. Writers aren't supposed to talk to actors, which I think is a pretty safe bet, even if you're not shooting. But he had his reservations. I think he might have done it differently. And the fact that he won the Academy Award for Platoon and he wrote JFK, and I think it gives his credentials, you know, pretty high marks. But look, he was another director and it was a different director's film. And so that's the case. But I don't think he hates the movie. I think maybe he would have approached it differently.
Well, he wanted more political content, right?
Well, so did Sidney Lumet at one point, because let's face it, you don't have cocaine coming into America without the government allowing it. Mm-hmm. And both men wanted more of this to come in. And particularly, as I try to write, as I said, in the book about the disparity in sentencing laws and in other ways also about the censorship of the film, they did jump into a hotbed of politics, law, and censorship when they made the movie.
The 83 film was 50 years about after the original. It's been 40 years since the 83 film. Are you aware of anyone trying to adapt it over again and reboot it?
There are some people who want to make another version of Scarface. Again, I write about this, but it's all written in smoke right now. Somebody even thought about making a sequel, which I don't understand.
What, they bring him back from the dead?
Well, that's the question. You really can. Although there's the shooter video game, which posits that Tony Montana survived his assassination attempt and went out after all the people who'd gone after him. There's a playthrough version of that lasts over an hour on YouTube, and you can watch the computer play the game. I'm not into that very much.
Yeah.
but people have thought about redoing it. I'm not sure what overlay they would use right now. Bitcoin, perhaps, is a way of killing people. Only Hollywood would remake a film that didn't make any money.
Yeah, there you go.
Matt Segaloff has been our guest. The book is Say Hello to My Little Friend. I won't even try the accent. A Century of Scarface. It was published in fall of this year, 2023, on the 40th anniversary of the great Brian De Palma, Al Pacino, Michelle Pfeiffer classic Scarface set in Miami in the post-Mariel Boatlift period. Thank you so much for your time today, Nat.
Thanks, guys. Thanks,
Nat. Thanks, Nat. This was great.
Greg, it's been a pleasure being with you all again, and I hope I'll speak to you soon.
When was the last time you saw Scarface, Craig? Gosh, for me, it has to have been 15 years maybe now.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I mean, parts of it are available on YouTube. And I think you can rent it on Amazon if you really wanted, if you haven't seen it before. But I mean, I think the movie, if you see it now, it comes across very differently than it did in 1983. Sure. I mean, then it was like a report from the front lines of the drug war. And now it's this sort of period piece.
You were living in Florida at the time. And as
I was only 13 then.
Ascended, right. But do you think it reflected poorly on the Cuban community in Miami? Because I look at it just as a piece of fiction, not like this is, I mean, that kind of thing was happening, but it to me, it's not documentary. It doesn't, it is not an insult to Cuban immigrants the way that you know some people there I think were worried about at the time.
I think grandstanding politicians will seize any issue that will make them appear good to their base. I would hope nobody would consider it a documentary, but it's true, and we've discussed this before, especially the our episode where we talked about that one year in Miami. Mm-hmm. You had the Mariel Boatlift, you had the cocaine war starting. And it was, you know,
the shooting death of what was it?
Arthur McDuffie. McDuffie shooting. Yeah. Where, you know, those things really happened. There were corrupt cops. There were, you know, big drug dealers. There were Marielitos who got involved in this stuff. So, it's not a documentary, but it's certainly drawing from real life.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.